Welcome to New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experience within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. So I am excited this morning to be here with Shiri, and I will introduce briefly, and then you can obviously fill in the gaps here. But just as a reminder, I'm Jeff Schaefer. I'm CEO of Common Good Capital. So Shiri Sandler, am I saying that right? She's a managing director of Agahosa Shalom Youth Village, which I'm sure she will give us what that means and everything. But this is unique because, full transparency, how we met is actually because a fund that I am involved with has a signed agreement. So it's not done, but we have a signed agreement to own a solar farm that sits on land owned by Agahosa Shalom in a very unique and creative structure to benefit the youth village for years to come. So, full transparency, that's how I met. Sorry, Shiri, I don't normally give that level of detail, but just for transparency. So welcome. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I don't normally do this, but start off just briefly and just tell us, you know, very quickly, Agahosa Shalom Youth Village, what is it? And then I want to backtrack and get a little bit of your history.
Sure. So let me start with what a youth village is. The idea behind a youth village is that every child deserves a safe family and a loving home. And when that's not possible due to familial trauma or societal level trauma, a youth village can step in and be as close as an institution can get to a family. So our youth village, we like to say, is a microcosm of a utopian society. It is a holistic intervention to help orphaned and vulnerable teenagers go on to live dignified lives. And we give those kids everything, as I said, that a family should give a child, whether it's access to education, whether it's access to food and healthcare, but centrally, it's access to love. The idea of living in a family that loves you. And the youth village is an example of the transformative power of that love. So we are in our 16th year. We work every year with 500 orphaned or vulnerable teenagers. And the youth village model itself came out of post-Holocaust reconstruction when the new state of Israel was dealing with the question of orphaned Holocaust survivors and how do we raise these kids, but thinking also, what will raising these kids do for our country? That idea was taken and adapted to the post-genocide context in Rwanda to say there are millions of orphans in Rwanda after the genocide, and they need for themselves to be raised in an environment with love and opportunity so that they have opportunity and dignity, but also because it's necessary for this country. And that's where Agahosa Shalom comes in. Our name is a evocation of our combined traditions. Agahozo is the Kinyarwanda, which is the Rwandan language, the Kinyarwanda word for a place where tears are dried. And Shalom, of course, means peace in Hebrew. So the idea is that this is a place where children can find peace and healing.
So you have communicated that message probably thousands of times, and you did a marvelous job. I had the pleasure of visiting Agahosa Shalom a month ago. I'll be back in Agahosa Shalom next week. And trying, as a layperson who's experienced it, but obviously it's not my job to communicate what Agahosa Shalom is, it is so hard for me to put it in words. And when you go step on the grounds of the village, what you just said is palpable. You experience it visually. You experience it emotionally. You experience it spiritually. And that's almost from the instant you're on there. So anyways, I was fascinated to hear you describe that because it's really hard to, for me, to bottle that up and to explain people. So I would encourage you to go, those listening, go to the website. You'll see some pictures. You'll see some videos. And I think it'll come to life even richer. And I'm sure as we go through this interview, it'll also become to life. You were going to say something else?
Yeah, I just want to respond to what you said. I think part of the reason It's so hard to explain a place like Agahozo Shalom is that if you think about your own life, it's very difficult to explain what family means to you, right? Because it's so central. And the only way to understand what family means is to put it against what you would be if you didn't have one. And I think that's the heart of the work we do, is to say, family has given me stability. It's given me love. It's given me opportunity, my sense of self, confidence, my worldview. What would I be without my family or a family or the family that has shaped me? I'd be so much emptier. I'd be so much more frightened. And so I think that's why it's really hard to explain, because the only way to see it is to see what you would be without it, which is what a lot of our kids come from, a space where they don't have a healed family to help them feel that security. And if you don't have that security, then you can't take advantage of opportunities given to you. Like, you know, if you think about a kid in school, if they haven't had three meals, doesn't matter what they're being taught, doesn't matter how strong they are. But even under the meals, if they've never been told they have worth, if they've never felt they have value, if they've never felt secure, they can't try.
You know, it's interesting. As you're talking, immediately my mind goes to, well, what about those individuals who hear this and their perception of family is actually not positive for whatever reason? And so what I'm thinking about when I was at the village, the difference to me is the village, whoever, you know, and you, I'm sure you'll tell about how it started. It was, I'm assuming over time, multiple people who are collectively defining what a family should be. And so it's different than just in my own family, because I get in my little myopic world. I only, but here it's almost like you've recreated what family could or should be over periods of time, very deliberately, where most families aren't practically thinking about and have all this collective wisdom to even change their own family. Does that resonate?
It completely resonates. And I think Americans tend to have a very narrow view of family, right? We think of the nuclear family. Other cultures, and Rwanda is a great example of this, think much more broadly of family. So if you go back to your life, Jeff, if you think about the ways that your nuclear family failed you or hurt you, or the things that they gave you that you then had to overcome, which I think for many of us is true, right? The idea of a perfect family
Sure.
is not a reality for most
Right.
people. Think about the other nets that you had, the other communities you had. Was it your educational community? Was it your faith community? Was it a sibling? Was it a friend you met in school or a teacher? Now imagine that all of those communities are fractured because of societal level trauma. The intersection of familial trauma or individual trauma and societal level trauma means that there's no level that can catch you. So if, you know, I think, for example, about my mother and the way my mother was an immigrant. They were refugees after the Holocaust. And she grew up as an immigrant in a very, very poor place. And when they came to America, school was the thing that caught her. And her parents were too young and too traumatized, but there was a broader community in many ways. But if she hadn't had school, if she hadn't had a school that had the resources to catch her, then where would she have ended up? You know, the first time I went to the village, as you said, I walked onto the campus and I felt that everything I looked at, the homes, the plantings, the view, this gorgeous view over Lake Mugesera in Rwanda, were all meant to tell me, you are worthy of beauty. You are worthy of healing. And I felt that deep inside. And I thought immediately, my God, what if my grandparents, who were child orphans of genocide, had had this? What do you need as a child? And what do you deserve as a child to help catch you? And that's what the village tries to give, because we're not just thinking, what do these children as individuals need? But what does this country need and deserve and have the capacity to do if the resources are there?
Okay, so I'm gonna step back. This is really good. There's many things I could say. I think I've told you in a previous conversation, I have a deep passion for men and women who've been incarcerated. And actually, this family unit is not only a nuclear family, but even a broader family unit is the same thing that comes into play there. Not always, but most of the time. Anyways, So let's go back. Where'd you grow up? Tell us about where you went to school and a little bit about your career.
Sure. So I grew up in Connecticut. My undergrad is from Cornell, and I did a master's in history at Brown. In between there, as an undergrad, I actually went to Budapest, Hungary, and did half a master's during my undergrad. And this was a very formative experience for me because I'd always been studying history. I grew up in a family where history was very much alive at the dinner table every night. It was very much a part of how I understood myself and my family and my responsibility. And I wanted to keep learning. I wanted to keep reading. When I got to college, I chose my major based on the major I thought would give me the most books to read, which is like a little perverse, you know.
That's probably not what most people are thinking.
Yeah, I figured this is not that audience. Y'all are numbers people, which I have great respect for because I am a word person. But when I was in college, the genocide in Darfur, Sudan, had started. And I grew up, as I said, in a genocide survivor family. When I was in college, the Darfur genocide was going on. And I wanted to be a Darfur activist. I wanted to study the Holocaust and study genocide. And I called my grandma, who I was very close with, and I told her that I wanted to study the Holocaust. And she was so angry. I'll never forget the sound of her voice. Like, I can hear it in my head. She said, no. She said, you know, my life had to be sad. And to a certain extent, your mother's life had to be sad. But your life doesn't have to be sad. And I said, Grandma, I have to. Like, I feel driven to do this. I feel called to do this. And she said, fine. But if you do it, you don't just do it for the Jews. You do it for everybody. And that became the thing that drove me. That became the mantra. So I got involved in Darfur genocide activism. And when I got out of graduate school, you know, I started working in the Holocaust and genocide space. I worked for a long time with the U.S. military, taking midshipmen and cadets from the U.S. service academies to Poland to see the concentration camps, for them to learn about the role of the military in genocide and to think about their own ethical obligations. Developed programs for medical, seminary, legal, and business school students to do the same, to think about the role of their profession in the Holocaust and what that means for their ethical obligations today. And now I've been with Aga Huzo Shalom for almost 7 years, and I love it. I get to be a part of something that my own family would have benefited from, right? But I also get to be a part of sort of standing together, that I'm Jewish and I grew up in a Jewish community that was largely a Holocaust survivor community. And I think of the Rwandans as sort of younger brothers in atrocity, that the Jews went through something that then the Rwandans had to go through too. And I get to be a part of enabling Rwanda to rebuild, right? My job is to make sure that the resources are there for the work we do in Rwanda. I don't determine program direction. We leave that to the Rwandans. They know what's right for Rwanda. But the philanthropy is in America and is in the West. And my job is to connect those two, is to help people in America, largely America, but other places too, feel the tie, feel the need, and feel the possibility of the work we're doing in Rwanda, and then get them to support that work. I think also any people, when you think about what is most important to you as an individual, as a community, you have to recognize that that need is present for someone else too, right? I think that's a basis of common humanity. And if you are fighting for it for yourself, I was raised to believe, then you have a responsibility to fight for it for others too.
Well, I imagine the empathy that you have is much greater than those who've not directly or knowingly been affected by, in this case, the Holocaust. So it's almost this idea of beauty out of ashes.
Yeah, I think there's a real commonality between the communities. And I think, you know, a lot of Jews who do this work are driven by the idea of thinking about providing an opportunity or a resource or support that wasn't there for their people. And in some ways, I feel that too. Being in the village, I can certainly think, like, what if my family had had this? But the other part is just that we all have something that calls to us. And for some of us, it's in our backyard, and for some of us, it's not. But that piece of what matters most to you, if you can put, well, let me speak for myself, I can put that passion to work, that empathy, that sense of connection to work, I'm going to be better at that job than I would be at any other job. And I'll also feel, I think, more alive, more engaged doing it than I would in any other position. If I can give myself that meaning, and in my job, if I can be a part of giving other people that meaning, then I am fulfilling my grandmother's edict, right? But I'm also fulfilling myself.
You're a great person to have on this podcast because you're not just talking about these ideas. You're living these ideas. You're working in these ideas. You're risking in these ideas. And so I hope and trust that hearing more stories or stories like yourself inspires people to live into that calling, even if it's not easy. I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, on one hand, what you do is amazing. On the other hand, being surrounded by the negative side of the reality of trauma and genocide and all that, it's got to be heavy too. So I'm sure there's a burden you carry as well.
It's certainly heavy. And on the one hand, I always say I would be thinking about these things every day. At least I'm doing something with it, right? At least I get to access a sense of hope. At least I get to feel empowered and effective. On the other hand, the first time I went to Rwanda, it was my second day in the country. One of my colleagues was taking me to the village, and he and I were the same age. We were, early 30s. And as we're driving there, he starts telling me, just like a regular topic of conversation, he starts telling me about his experience during the genocide. And if I had closed my eyes, he could have been any Holocaust survivor I grew up hearing at the dinner table. My grandparents and their friends used to talk about the war all the time. And that was actually a terrible feeling because not to have to listen to the suffering. That is hard, but it's an honor. But the sense that 50 years apart, it happened again, and nobody stopped it. And what my grandparents went through didn't stop it from happening to another child. To hear the exact same words is devastating, right? To understand that that the world didn't stand up. That part is very hard. But again, getting to be a part of a solution, that's an honor.
So you maybe have already answered this question, but I'm going to go ahead and throw it out there anyways. And this is a mouthful. So how would you best describe who you are in the context of where you're at in your life journey?
When I think about my life journey, one of the things I think about is the way I like to think about it is my theme. Someone said to me in my first years out of college, take all the things you've ever loved doing in your personal life, as a student, as a, professional, and find what's common to them. That's your theme. How can you find a job that enables you to live that theme? And for me, that theme is creating meaningful experiences and connecting people to and through those experiences. And being at this point where I know what I love and I know what I'm good at, I feel very lucky. Now, I have no idea where it will take me, which is exciting and terrifying. I don't know what comes next. I've never been very good at imagining what comes next, which means I'm, on the one hand, I think disappointed less and maybe also disappointed more. I'm not sure. But that sort of, I know who I am is one of the things I think about where I am on my life journey. And maybe the excitement is there's always new pieces of yourself to discover. There's always new ways to engage your passions. There's always new skills that I could turn out to have and to love. And I try to think about those as opportunities in the future.
If you then, and you can answer this either the here and now or even to a broader calling, or maybe the two line up, how are you trying to change the world, whether it be small, whether it be large?
I think I'm trying to change the world in multiple ways. You know, I'm a parent, and I think every parent is trying to change the world, right? Because we are trying to change and create a world for our children, but also just the way we parent is trying to change something. It's trying to offer something to our children. And I think about that a lot also as a professional, because I work not directly with kids, right? But in helping to create an environment for children. And on that level, I want a world where people feel secure in who they are, in knowing, like the way that I was just able to say, I understand my theme, I understand who I am, I understand the ways I can be effective. I want that for young people. I want them to have that capacity and be able to work in those spaces for themselves. We always say in the village that our goal isn't that every kid will go to college. Our goal is that every kid will have access to the opportunities that are right for them. And it feels very touchy-feely, but it also is a very economic goal, right? We want to see a Rwanda where job creation and access to technology, access to resources, access to industry means that each of our kids can have a job that is right for them, that those jobs exist, that we are not seeing wasted potential. We are not seeing people living at a subsistence level who, if the work was there, could be living at a much higher level and raising up their communities and raising up their families. And then when I think on sort of the global level, you know, part of what we are trying to do at Agahosa Shalom is create a model for communities that have gone through societal level trauma, for them to have a way to raise and love and protect their children. And if I think about the impact I really want to have, I think that's the dream, right? That there is a known intervention used on the local level and used on the multinational level that communities from incarcerated, you know, post-incarcerated families in America to Haiti to post-war Ukraine can use to ensure that societal level trauma doesn't impact individuals and the nation for generations to come.
So this is a question that may be hard for you to answer, and it may not be fair for me to ask it, but I'm going to ask it. We'll go from there. And maybe take off your politically correct hat. This is just open kimono as to what Agahosa Shalom is all about. So if you were to say in one aspect that you could translate to other communities or villages, what is the central part of Agahosa Shalom that makes it unique or that you could want to replicate in other communities? And I get that in an ideal world, there's probably multiple, but I'm just curious if you have one thing that at least is in the center.
There are certainly multiple, but I think what's in the center is dignity and love. Agahosa Shalom is founded ostensibly on this Israeli model, right? But what was done to that model was to make it Rwandan. Remember when we were talking about family? In Rwanda, it is common for people to raise other family members' children after the parents die. So when I was recently in the village, I was sitting with one of the family mamas. Our kids live in a family structure within the village, and each group of 20-ish kids lives in a home within the village with a staff member known as a mama. And I asked one of the family mamas how many kids she had. And she said, children of my body or children I have raised. And I thought this was a brilliant distinction because they're all her children, right? ASYV was built on the idea that Rwandan culture has held dear for centuries, which is when a family loses a parent, when a child loses a parent, there are other people in the community who will take that child and raise it and love it as their own. And to me, this is applicable in the specific, but also in the broad, which is we have traditions. Most communities have traditions that were meant to help keep the community safe. America is a very individualistic society. Things are different here. But a lot of communities, if you think about your church or your town, there are self-help organizations, right? That don't rely on the federal government, that don't even rely necessarily on the state government. But when someone dies in your neighborhood, my guess is you have a tradition. You bring them food or you mow their lawn or whatever it may be. And I think there is a lot of value in looking back to the best of us, right? The best of how we care for each other and relying on those ideals. And that to me is dignity. That's looking at and recognizing the dignity in our traditions, the dignity in ourself and in our capacity. And then I think the other part is love. You know, again, going back to the mamas at Agape Hozel Shalom, one of them asked, I was in the village with a group of donors a couple of years ago, and one of the mamas said, well, I'm curious about how you in America take care of the orphans in your own communities, which was met with silence, because we don't. We've become so atomized that we don't feel a responsibility necessarily for people we don't know. And I think if we can free ourselves to love our communities and children and our families and ourselves, I think if we can give ourselves the space and the training to recognize our emotions, deal with our emotions, process them, move through them, we are better able, we are more effective in our work, we are more effective in our families, we are more effective in our communities. And I think that healing is incredibly important, both for moving past trauma and preventing trauma on an individual and on a societal level.
As you were speaking the first part of that and talking about effectively the love of neighbor, you know, as a family unit, what strikes me is you have Rwanda, which is very much community-based, if that's a right vernacular. And on the positive sense, these mamas talk about how, you know, loving not only their own biological, but other children. Yet on the extreme other side, you have complete destruction of neighbor killing neighbor. There's something about listening to a Rwandan and heeding their wisdom, because they've lived at about the most extremes anybody can. So, and I won't tell the whole story, but I was in the back of a taxi with a young man 3 or 4 years ago. I think he must have been 35, if I'm doing the math right. He was a survivor. His family had, many had been wiped out. And one of the things I asked him is, if you could get on a loudspeaker or on whatever the TV and say anything to America, what would you say? And this is his words, not mine. He said, you need to learn to forgive. Coming from somebody who lost a father to actually his best friend's dad is the one who killed him. And for him to say, I had to learn to forgive, it's almost like the mic drops going, you know this better than anybody. I hear you. So it's interesting. The darkest, darkest places, when light shines through, we ought to be running to that truth, because it probably is the most pure we're going to ever hear.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful way to put it. You know, it's interesting. I used to speak publicly with my grandmother a lot. She would tell her story of survival. We would talk together. We spoke at state houses and schools. A kid made a documentary about her. I mean, we did this a lot. And people would ask her if she could forgive. And she always struggled with it. She would look at me with this look on her face. And one of the things she would say in part was, she said, you know, I've never gone back to Germany. My grandmother was a German Jew. She said, I've never gone back to Germany because I don't know that the man standing next to me on the platform waiting for the train isn't the man who killed my father. In Rwanda, one of the things you have to do to be forgiven is speak the truth and show where the bodies are buried, quite literally. And I think that's incredibly powerful, that truth can lead to forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
That trust, and trust is a requirement for truth, right? You have to trust the process, you have to trust the outcome, and you have to need it, I think, also. And in Rwanda, community is, I think, in many ways, the thing that people rely on to move forward, because there's no choice. My grandmother didn't have to look at the man next to her on the train platform because she could leave Germany. Rwandans didn't leave. They had to stay, most of them, many of them. And there's a very strong national narrative in Rwanda about rebuilding the country, about moving from what was essentially a failed state by international standards to the tech hub of Africa, which is what it is now. You know, the Singapore of Africa, that if you want to build a business in Africa, you go to Rwanda to do it, because there's very little corruption, because it's very business friendly, you know, because there's no natural, or there's very few natural resources in Rwanda. There's essentially the gorillas. And so the government has made the people the natural resource of Rwanda. And I think you cannot move forward in that way without relying on each other, without trust, without truth, and without forgiveness. And I think you're right. I think that is a shining light. And it's something we have to learn from in America. And I think when you think about it also sort of on the micro level, it's something we have to learn from in our own individual communities, that we can be very transient here. We can move away from a community we grew up in a way that in a place like Rwanda, you don't really. And so I think we've let each other become expendable. We've let trust and truth also become expendable, and they're not.
You jog my memory. One of the other things that this young man said in the back of his car, and this was speaking to Americans, don't think it can't happen to you. And, you know, translating to my other passion, which is men and women behind bars, one of the statements that it's gone through my head for 31 years, the first time I ever went into a prison as a visitor, was until you can view yourself as an inmate, you don't fully understand grace. And even, you know, what this young man in the back of the taxi was saying is, look, you don't want to admit it, but truth is, we all have the capacity to do really bad things, and coming to grips with that. So this whole idea of truth. And so again, going back to my prison stuff, what's fascinating is when you find men and women who have come to realize that what they've done is wrong, the transparency that they often have, now not all of them, is complete freedom, because they fully acknowledge it, fully move, surrendered it, and can move forward. And they're some of the most dynamic people I've ever met, and they're sitting behind bars, but they're living in truth.
I think this is beautiful. I think one of the things you just said to me translates as admitting our failures doesn't make us less. Admitting our failures makes us stronger. And I think that's as an individual and as a nation. You know, I used to work with the military, and one of the things that would come up when we were, you know, in the camp of Auschwitz and in the town of Oświęcim next to Auschwitz often was this idea of, well, it would never happen in America. It could never happen in America. And part of being raised by genocide survivors is knowing that it can happen anywhere. It doesn't matter what our protections are if we don't believe in and respect those protections, but it also doesn't matter what our protections are if we don't believe in and respect each other. And, you know, there's a line in the Passover service in the Haggadah that we read every year that says, it's as though you yourself went out of Egypt. Jews are taught to relate to our history as memory. And it can be very complicated, but it also means that the people who came before me don't feel far away. And what they went through doesn't feel far away from my experience. And in fact, I am taught to let it inform my experience. So it means I never feel inoculated from something like a plague or a genocide, right? That these things are part of what my worldview is built from. Now, is that a little bit maybe of some intergenerational effects of trauma because of my Holocaust survivor grandparents? Probably, but that's not what this podcast is about. You know, But I think that sense of recognizing how fragile things are is really important. And that if we want democracy and freedom, we have to be supporting it actively. And we have to be watching ourselves and the people we care about and our communities and the media and whatever else, because language is powerful. They will tell you in Rwanda, and my grandparents would tell me, language is powerful. Language is the first step. And that goes the other direction too, right? That language is the first step to empowerment of yourself. That learning to speak your truths, to speak your feelings, to speak your capacity. We teach that to our kids in the village. We want them to express themselves because that's how they learn to heal. But then we also want them to be brave enough to speak up in class, to answer the question, to question things, because critical thinking is one of the bases of sort of academic freedom, right? And for yourself, of academic opportunity is critical thinking. And I think those all play in together.
So this is going longer than than normal. No, and it's a wonderful thing. So don't take that. I literally in my head, I'm like, where do we go from here? Because I'm going to actually skip some normal questions I ask. But I think there's two things I'd love to end with. And so you tell me in what order you want to do this. The first is, off of what you just said, when you stand in the middle of the village, and you're going to know the story better, so I want to hear you articulate it. There is the road, which then goes to the amphitheater. Can you just describe what that road means? And then when you get to the amphitheater, what do you see? And then what transpires at that amphitheater? Because I think, based on what I heard, the word or words and courage get exemplified in that. So if you could articulate that, and then I'll come back with the last question after that.
I'm going to give you, so you just are talking about the heart of the body of the village, and I want to lay out, if I can, the whole body of the
okay.
village. So the village is quite large. It's 154 acres, and a number of those acres, you know, belong to the solar field. The village is built high up on hills about an hour and 15 minutes east of Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. This land came from 99 landowners. And when our founder, Ann Heyman, was building the village, someone said to her, you know, you can, the government will buy the land for you and you can buy it from the government. And she said, no, I want to go to each of these landowners individually, buy the land because I want them on the side of the village. And she sat under the mango tree, which is in the center of the village, and signed all the deeds right over from these landowners individually, 99 land plots. She put the mango trees at the center, and then you have in concentric circles, the administration buildings and then the family houses, so that everything is in circles around the center. So everyone's looking towards each other. But then you have this walk up the hill, up, 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 keep going up, like 20-minute walk up the hill to the school, which is literally higher up than the village. And Anne always said it's because the head is the highest part of the body, right? And she wanted the separation of home and school. So the kids really felt they were moving towards a purpose when they walked up towards the village. Now, if you walk down from the school into the center, and then you walk down Seafar Road, you end up in the amphitheater. And from the amphitheater, you have this gorgeous view, as you actually do from the school. So you can see it from just the two places, Lake Mugesera in the distance. And you see over the hills into Burundi, which is a neighboring country. Anne's idea was that if you see far, you will go far, which is why the school can look at Mugesera. And when you see it from the amphitheater, you know you will go far. And so the idea is that academics can take you far, and what happens in the amphitheater can take you far. And what happens in the amphitheater every week is an event called Village Time, which is a talent show. And everybody has a talent. All of you listening, you all would be put up on stage at Village Time too. Maybe you're doing live math. I don't know what it is, but we have everything from dance to modeling to spoken word to poetry to traditional music to rap music to live painting. The idea is every kid has a talent. Every kid can have a passion. And I think a passion is something that ties you more closely to life. Right? Think about yourself. Think about fishing or sports or whatever it is that you love to do in your free time that gives you something to look forward to. Those are things our kids never had access to. Right? We have professional artists now who before they came to the village had never seen art supplies. We have kids who love to code, who before they came to the village had never touched a computer. Every kid has the opportunity to get up at village time and express themselves. And every single kid is going to get applause when they are done, because it is an act of bravery and it is an act of trust to get up and express yourself in a language that wasn't your language in front of, 600 other people. And so that's really sort of, if you picture the village, the spine of the village is the school to the amphitheater and is that CFAR road. I joke that everything in the village is called either CFAR or GOFAR, but, you have to say the things you believe. You have to repeat them to teach them to your children. And so that's what we do in the village.
And one day my hope is that those listening can walk down CFAR road, because you can't articulate it until you see it. The view and the expansiveness is just awesome. Okay. So the last kind of concept is your job is to raise capital for the sustainability of the village. So when did you realize the power of capital? And mind you, it doesn't have to be money. And what does that mean to you? Any thoughts you have on that would be awesome to hear.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's sort of two clear points in my life. So when I was growing up, my family sponsored a number of families of refugees to bring them over to the States. And those kids, I grew up very close to some of those kids and those families. And those families were very much intertwined with mine. And as I grew up, I realized that the reason we could do that was money, right? Money hadn't bought my family's safety during the Holocaust, but it could help other families. And the money part, but also the emotional ties we developed with those families were equally important. And I think those pieces are both capital. The resources, when I talk about resources, if I think about my staff, I think about who they are as people, I think about the money we pay them, and I think about the skills they bring in, and all of those resources are vital. And, I think the second big turning point for me in the way I think about capital and its relationship, especially to opportunity, this was actually very recently. It was a couple of years ago, must have been, 5, 8 years ago. I was talking to my grandmother about why they came to the States. They had been, my family in 45, my grandparents met in 45 after liberation. They had my mother in 47 in Paris, which is just the place they were able to go to. And then they went in 49 to Israel, to the new state. And it was very difficult. They were very, very poor. They lived in a tent city. And I always thought they came to the States in 56 because of safety. And I remember saying that to my grandmother and she said, no, that's not why we came. I said, wait, why did you come? She said, jobs. She said, sure, there were no jobs. And I realized the role that money and financial opportunity and employment opportunity played in my family's life and therefore in my life were much bigger than I had ever understood. When I think about the village, people always ask me, what's the thing that keeps you up at night? And I'm like, well, the money, if I don't raise the money, it's not there. Right. We can't feed the kids. They go home. Like, what happens,
Right.
But it's also the environment of it. That we can do so much for our kids, but if the jobs don't exist in Rwanda for our kids to get, they're still going to go back to where they came from. And maybe they're more healed and they have, they're changed on the inside, but how much is their opportunity going to change? How much can the future of the country change? And so much depends on investment in a country like this. So much depends on workforce development and infrastructure development in an economy like that. When I look at unemployment numbers, when I look at, GDP, I'm thinking about what that means on the individual level and how much squandered opportunity there is there, and therefore how much individual and familial trauma is going to come out of that. And so that's, I think, really the way I think about capital.
So then I don't put words in your mouth, but just listen to you speak. parsing through it, clearly there's capital that's needed for the village, philanthropic capital, but you're also articulating that there is capital, investment capital needed in infrastructure and job creation. So it's interesting that your job is to raise capital for the village, which is charitable. And yet your answer was capital holistically needs to go there, not just in the philanthropic side.
Completely. I mean, I don't know how many of you listening are soccer fans, but if you are a fan of Arsenal, you will know Rwanda because their kit, right, their jersey says Visit Rwanda. And Paris Saint-Germain, they have a partnership with Rwanda, and Bayern Munich has a partnership with Rwanda. And we have seen a clear difference in visitorship and tourism in Rwanda with those efforts. Tourism in Rwanda translates into two things: visitors to the village for us, which is vital and financially vital, and two, global interest and awareness of Rwanda outside of the genocide, which is vital because it brings investment and philanthropy. I think all of these things are tied together. I think impact investing in a place like Rwanda brings everything from capital to this conversation. One of the really interesting things about Rwanda specifically is that as a nation, it is very uninterested in Western aid. It doesn't want aid. Mm-hmm. It wants investment because they want Rwandan solutions. They want Rwandan ideas. They want a Rwandan future. They do not want a dependent future. They do not want, you know, Western ties that are telling them how to run their country. They, as I said, go back to this idea of Rwandan dignity, of agaciro, which is we know the answer, we know the way forward from our own past, from our own culture. But what Rwanda needs to make that possible is investment, is tourism, is business, is a different face on the world stage than just 30 years after the genocide.
One last connection. You know, I'll talk to people, and I involve with multiple kind of impact things, investments, but one of them is investing in some businesses that are run by and that hire formerly incarcerated. And inevitably, I will have somebody say, are you using them? Or why not just give them money? And my answer is ultimately that there is a place for charity, and there is a place to just help and give a handout to these individuals. But you said the word, and I've heard this many times as it relates to Africa, is, and this is where Americans, I think, fall down. When you see somebody as investment worthy, there's real dignity in that because you're saying, I'm investing in you because I believe in you. I believe in you that you're going to make money for yourself, and I believe that you're going to make money for me. That's a totally different level, a different playing field than here's money, here's a handout. And again, You need both. But one of my missions is to challenge people, and this goes a little, I mean, I know you agree, so I don't, but this is not to dissuade people from giving to charity. But I think a lot of Americans view charity as more holy than a great impact investment. And my answer is you need them both.
I think there's a really important piece under here, which is power. Charity, philanthropy, vitally important. You want to give philanthropy to ASYV? We are. Please, yeah. Come talk to me, right? I will very rarely say no to that. But I think with philanthropy can sometimes come a removal of power, right? If you are giving and someone is receiving, you are, in many minds, the more powerful one. I think when you invest, mm-hmm. it's even. And the thing is, there's a movement in philanthropy called trust-based philanthropy, which is really about evening out that power structure in philanthropy to say, we are investing with philanthropy, we are giving to your ideas, and you are the one who will decide what to do with these funds. You will decide what is best for your community and how to use it. You know best, we simply have the capital. And I think that's really important. But I also think if we only look at a place like Rwanda as the recipient of aid and not a generator of worthy ideas, we will never fix this power imbalance. And I think that's really important that when you invest in a country, whether it's through a deep and meaningful relationship with a nonprofit, or it's through impact investing, or it's through visiting, you are more likely to see common humanity. And I think common humanity and recognition, sort of the commonality of opportunity, the commonality of brilliance, those things are really important to our global future. We are all tied together. The only way for us to succeed is to succeed together. And I think these are very important pieces of that.
This has been awesome. Thank you for your transparency, your vulnerability. Thank you for inspiring us. And I know that your inspiration comes from your family legacy and what you're called to do, but it also comes from, I know, the change that you see with the, do you call them students? What do you call?
We call them students or just kids, our okay. kids. Yeah.
I mean, for another time, I'm sure you could rattle off amazing story after story. And I'm sure there's still some heartbreaking stories, but I can't imagine that you'd keep doing this if you didn't see amazing results coming from these kids. So I, you know, and I've been to your website and so, and I've experienced it firsthand. It is, I would encourage everybody to nothing else, go to the website, read a little bit. And then if you get really daring, go to Rwanda and visit. And I think it will, and I know you purposely don't call it an orphanage. And I understand after going why. And so it'll be fascinating if people can actually go see it themselves. But we are going to try next year to take, or maybe even later this year, to actually spend a night there, take some financial advisors and stay at the village. Because I think that would be, well, I mean, the views and it are stunning. But I think to actually be in it for 24 hours would even be that much more special than just a short visit.
Yeah, I think, you know, we always say the best way to understand the village is in the words of our kids. So, you know, go to the website or our YouTube page, listen to our kids. I am going to tell you one story. I'm going to tell you two. We had a kid in one of our first classes who was a genocide survivor. He, you know, came to the village as a teenager. He had lost his parents. He'd grown up with his grandparents. And he ended up going to the University of Pennsylvania and working high up at the Bank of Kigali. And then now is working on a startup in the like food tech industry in Rwanda. And he, you know, we always say brilliance is equally spread, opportunity isn't. He's one of the people who's going to be building the future economy of Rwanda. There's another kid from the same starting classes who also a genocide survivor, was 9 months old when the genocide ended, parents were dead, and he works in the village now. And when you visit the village, you meet him, Eric Kabiona, who you've probably met. And he is building a new Rwanda too by working in our village, by giving to the next generation of kids. These kids have this, they're not kids anymore. I mean, they're 30. They have this incredible dedication to their country, this incredible belief in their country. But, you know, when you come to the village, you meet staff like them, but then you also meet students. I will never forget this kid who, my God, I felt so dumb. I met him in our science center. And he was talking to me about coding. And again, right, I'm a word person. I know nothing about coding. And he was saying, well, you know, I've been wanting to use a Raspberry Pi. And I remember thinking, I have no idea what that is. Like, I assume you're not talking about a dessert. You know, and sometimes it's interacting with this brilliance, these kids who have this connection to something academic. And you can just see this amazing future out there for them. But you got to, yeah, I mean, you have to see it for yourself to understand what is possible and what we could all be a part of one way or another.
And we don't need to take a lot of time, but I need you to help process this with me. Because when I talk about the village, I want to explain to people and just their perceptions in their brain, it's an orphanage, it's a sad place. But I almost want to say, don't be sad for these kids. They're in a great spot, yet I know where they've been and what they've come from. So how do I reconcile that? Because I don't want people, I mean, I want them to be empathetic, but they're also in an amazing place and an amazing environment. Have you felt that tension?
Completely. And I think it's not an orphanage, right? It's a community. It's this microcosm of a utopian society idea, I think, is actually really powerful, because an orphanage reduces a kid to their orphan status. The village provides a holistic community that all of us could use, mm-hmm. right? That gives a kid everything they could need in one place. I think of the village as a place of hope. An orphanage is a place of sadness. This is not an orphanage. This is the best boarding school you can imagine, right? It's the most vibrant community center you've ever seen. It's focused on possibility and on the future. And I think that's the difference. On the one hand, we don't call it an orphanage because it's not. But on the other, we don't call it an orphanage because the idea of an orphanage is an idea of last resort. The idea of a youth village is really the idea of first resort, right? It's let's take children and give them what we all want for our children, not the least we can give them, but the most.
It starts with the word orphanage versus village, which then translates into action. And again, go back to the power of a word. That is the great example of it, how powerful that word is then when it's played out. And I'll shut up. You just got to go visit it because that's the only way you can experience it. So
yes, come see us and then go see the gorillas. Appreciate, the beauty of Rwanda. Change any perspective you had on this country.
Thank you so much for your time. I have thoroughly enjoyed it. For those who are listening, don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital. Rate us and review us on all the different platforms. And until next time, this is Jeff Schaefer. Shiri, anything you want to say in closing?
It was an honor to be here. It was so much fun. I hope I see you all in Rwanda.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.